morning and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Good morning and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, broadcast live from the WMGNA headquarters in Farmington, Connecticut. I'm Daniel Friedman, CEO of WMGNA, and I am excited to be joined this morning by my good friend and colleague, Chris Elliott, CPA and partner at Adam San Martino and Company, PC, in sunny Bristol, Connecticut.
Good morning, Chris. Everybody. Yeah, how are you? Very good.
I'm loving the snow. I'm great. All right. Well, we've got a 30-minute show. We're going to get started. We are here with our capable engineer and producer, Melody Simpson. Melody, why don't you give everyone the call-in number this morning?
All right. If anybody has any questions in relation to tax stocks, please call in at 929-477-1568.
Okay. All right. Well, here we go, Chris. Something very exciting that's on my mind is the Section 179 in bonus depreciation for small businesses. I know that we ourselves here at WMGNA have utilized these techniques, and other folks that we're working with are utilizing them. Can you explain some 179 depreciation and bonus depreciation for small businesses in 2015? What should folks be looking for?
Well, I mean, let's first talk about 2014, because 2014 was kind of a strange year. The IRS passed and made retroactive the bonus depreciation in Section 179 rules. So essentially, if you're a small business and you bought, you know, equipment or computers or even vehicles, the government basically gave you two options. One was a special bonus depreciation provision, which you can write off up to 50% of the cost of that asset in year one, and then depreciate the residual, meaning that you get a great tax benefit in year one. The bonus depreciation was one of those aspects. The other piece is Section 179, which is allowing any type of small business to write off in one shot up to $500,000 worth of equipment. So these were very massive late changes that were done with Congress in early January, very, very kind of debated. But the big issue here, this is not extended to 2015. So a lot of these bonus depreciation laws right now have been clipped out of the law. And Section 179, which is the one-time expensing of any equipment, was dropped down to $25,000. So very substantial. So in 2015, we're not really certain where that's going to go with the law, because there's a tremendous amount of tax reform going on. So we're going to have to wait and see. But it was a great planning opportunity for 2014 taxpayers to take advantage of this. So,
okay,
definitely.
So, go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, as we're kind of anticipating this year, I think it's very important from a planning aspect to make sure that, you know, you're taking a look at your assets, you're spending them wisely. The politicians are probably going to wait until the end of the year to really make any determinations as to where these laws are going to go. But if I were to guess, bonus depreciation is going to disappear from the law. And Section 179, which is the one-time expensing of assets, will probably not be $25,000, but it's probably going to be somewhere in mid-between. We're never going to see these types of tax benefits ever again, in my opinion, because with all the reform that's going on. So it was a big planning opportunity that, unfortunately, if you didn't take advantage of it in 2014, it was a big loss. Definitely something that we're not really certain where it's going to go, but we'll keep
an eye on it. All right. So, the plan accordingly, obviously, equipment and purchases, businesses need to make them, and we shall see what tax benefits come out of that. All right, good stuff. We're going to jump around a little here. There's a technique that we've been using with a lot of folks, again, are setting up these 529 college savings plans in order to shield money from the increase in taxes that we've seen over the last couple of years, allow the matriarchs and patriarchs of families to control these monies, and then ultimately have them used for post-secondary education for their children, grandchildren, and future generations. Can you comment a little on the tax and the planning opportunity side and the tax benefits for Connecticut residents utilizing 529 plans?
I love these 529 plans. I mean, they are such a great product. I mean, they're essentially the state of Connecticut, if you're a state of Connecticut resident, the Connecticut Higher Education Trust, CHET, kind of abbreviated, is a program that they have that the state of Connecticut provides to you or gives you on your tax return a 5% tax credit up to the first $10,000 that's put into a college plan. So it's a $500 tax credit that you get on the state, which is, it really adds up. Outside of Connecticut, you see a lot of traditional 529 plans, either through Fidelity or through different states. I myself have a Fidelity plan that's linked up with my credit card, and essentially 2% of my purchases go into a 529 account for my children, and it's capped out at about $1,500. So that's linked up. It's a plan. It's a program with Fidelity and MasterCard. So I do a lot of charging on my credit card, so it really does help. But what I like about it, Dan, is the tax deferral, the growth. It's all tax-free as long as you use that money for higher education, depending on how it's invested wisely, it could really, really benefit you. I love tax deferral growth rather than accumulating taxable income, because now what's happening is that because there's going to be, in the future, there's going to be less benefit, the value of our deductions are going to be less, with some of the reform that they're looking at. The only way we can control our income is through what we're investing and what we're spitting out. So any type of tax deferral growth is what I highly recommend. Just make sure it's invested wisely.
Excellent. A couple follow-ups there. Speaking of taxes and tax reform, I know there's been out in the news, and people have asked me, is the tax-free withdrawal of these 529 something that's in jeopardy? I think it was part of a President Obama or some tax trade-offs. What have you heard about that?
I've heard kind of mixed comments. I mean, it's a great point because, you know, when you take a look, and we've gone to Jack Surgeon is a renowned tax speaker, and every year we go to his seminars, and we hear a lot of the chatter going on about what they're throwing around, and the Republicans and the Democrats have different types of thoughts. I mean, they've been toying at the ideas of eliminating Roth IRAs and eliminating pre-tax benefits into retirement plans, some crazy stuff. But I got to tell you, I've heard that on multiple occasions. I'm a little concerned about it. I'm concerned as to what type of reform, you know, is going to kind of transpire here because, you know, in theory, there's seven brackets that we have currently at the federal level, and they're looking to condense those down to maybe three or four brackets. But then the value of your deductions, you know, mortgage interest, charitable donations, taxes, property taxes, we've all taken advantage of those over the past couple of years to reduce our income. And now I think what's going to happen is that once we get over a certain threshold, those deductions are going to phase back, and we're going to lose the value of those. So it wouldn't surprise me, Dan, that would come into play. Again, it's it's scary to think about because it's such a great plan and incentivize families to put money away into college. But who knows? These politicians have so many thoughts that it's delirious to follow sometimes. So.
Yes, yes, yeah. That's a point well taken. And my comments have been on the big picture is that often tax reforms, things that have gone on, are grandfathered in, and then maybe going forward, they will limit tax-free withdrawals based on income or something going forward. But to change the rules, while it has happened, is not typically what we end up seeing. Tax reform of 86, you couldn't do things that you could do, but if you already had some things cooking. The last thing on the 529s is it is an opportunity to front load your gifts. So explain how, my mother and stepfather, Grandma Sally and Grandpa Peter might go ahead with I think there's 10 grandkids now. I've lost track of all my, I've got track of my three kids, but my nieces and nephews scattered all over the place. How could they go about if they wanted to front load some 529 plans for their grandkids?
Yeah, so essentially each person on this earth is entitled to gift up to $14,000 per year. And the way that you see a lot of grandparents and parents do this is they, you know, when you put money into a 529 plan, it is a gift. So there's a special provision that allows a five-year front-loaded gift. So essentially it's $70,000 or $14,000 per year per person for 5 years that you can front-load into these college plans. And, it's a nice opportunity if you have some money and your intent is, to put that money away for your child for school or even, a grandparent may opt to do it. Great opportunities to do that. I see a lot of people taking advantage of that. And, you can get that invested, depending on the timing of the market, it could be pretty beneficial for you. So that is a gift. It's a five-year kind of moratorium there. You just got to be careful that if you do that, that any other gifts that you give outside of that may require a tax filing. So just got to be kind of careful when you're doing that front-loaded gift that you're maxing out your benefit. And it just may require, some people may give gifts outside of college that once it goes above $14,000, you may have a requirement to file a gift tax return to report those transactions in excess of that. So.
Okay. All right. Good points. Okay. 929-477-1568. Call in live now with your questions. Chris, we're gonna jump over to something else that is on folks' mind that we're also handling questions. With all the healthcare changes, the implementation, the delay, the change of some laws on the healthcare mandate, what can you tell us about the healthcare mandate and what do individuals and businesses have to comply with?
This is a topic that we can probably talk for hours on, but I'm going to try to condense it very simply into two areas. Let's first talk about the individual mandate. So, and this is all kind of drilling down from the Obamacare. In essence, the individual mandate came into play requiring everybody to have affordable health insurance. And so for 2014, everybody is required to have some form of health insurance. Now, the marketplace, also called the exchange, is the place that typically people will go to purchase their insurance, and businesses also do the same thing. Now, there's essentially a lot of these different types of subsidies and advanced tax credits that they have available now for people who are lower income or what they call the federal poverty level. So what happens is you go to the marketplace, you purchase your insurance. There's multiple layers of it. There's bronze plans, there's platinum plans, there's silver plans. There's essentially you select the health insurance that is suitable for you and your family, and then you provide them with your income or an estimate of your income, and they calculate. There's two ways they calculate if you're eligible for a subsidy. Now, the subsidy has two layers to it. There's two options. One is called an advanced premium tax credit, which in theory what you do is you provide to them an estimate of what your income is. They figure out what that premium tax credit is. Then they reduce your premium by that throughout the whole year. And then at the end of the year, you file a tax return. You get what they call a 1095A form from the exchange. And depending on how your income actually ended up, you may actually have to repay some of that tax back if you underestimated your income, or you may get a premium tax credit. The other option is what they call a cost-sharing reduction program, which in theory is just kind of reducing some of your out-of-pocket costs, your deductibles, co-insurance, co-pays, what have you. That individual mandate is a requirement. There's a penalty that's imposed that if you do not have the minimum tax, there's in 2014 it's a $95 penalty per adult or $47.50 per child, up to $285 per family, or 1% of your family income, whichever is greater. So when you take a look at your household income, that's kind of defined as for a family, you take your whole household income and you get to subtract out $20,000 for a family, and that figure multiplied times 1% is the figure, and you take the greater of the two. So it's kind of complicated, but a lot of people are saying, gee, should I just pay the penalty? Should I pay the, should I get insurance? Why should I be forced to do it? So it's a very debatable issue, but the individual mandate is really enforced for 2014 and future years. Now, from a business perspective, the requirement for companies, businesses to provide insurance got a little bit more flexible in 2015, because it used to be that if you had full-time equivalents of 50 or less employees, you were required, 50 or more, you were required to offer affordable health insurance to your employees. They increased that to 100 employees for 2015. So it gave a lot of small businesses a kind of a breather for this year. But going to next year, in 2016, if you have more than 50 full-time employees, you are required to offer affordable health insurance to everybody. So the law itself is so in depth. We can talk for hours on it, but it's one of those things, Dan, where as a business owner, you need to be prepared for these types of premiums that you may have to bear. And a lot of people are trying to manipulate it and reduce their employees down from full time to part time. So it's a big cost that you may have to endure. So that's kind of the gist of it.
We're not going to spend hours, but as you said, it is a arduous and complicated matter, and we are dealing with our small business owner clients, and if there's people out there that need some more in-depth consultation on this, because as you said, it is a law, and you have to comply with it, and there are obviously techniques to minimize the company's exposure and still comply, and that's often where we come in. Okay, let's go to another piece of legislation that affects a lot of folks, that there is some confusion and some surprise, surprise, some laws and regulations change at the last second. A technique that we often use, we've got folks taking required minimum distributions from their IRAs, and they're fortunate enough to not necessarily need that income for their lifestyle, and they'd like to preserve some of that social capital as opposed to sending it off to the government. We have them directing it to charities right from the custodian to the charity. That was allowed right at the end of 2014, correct?
Yeah, they took it out of the law, then brought it back with the late amendments to some of the tax laws there. So it was put into place.
How does that affect 2015?
It has not been extended yet.
It's not been extended yet.
It's out of the law right now. But I got to tell you, just one thing, guys. I loved this benefit, especially for somebody who is relatively higher income that has a big charitable intent. You can take $100,000 out of your IRA and direct that right into your charity, and the transaction would be non-taxable to you. So it's a great. I hope they reinstill that back into the law, because it really incentivized a lot of people who are in this required minimum distribution zone, you know, to redistribute that. I mean, if you're putting money and giving money to charities, it doesn't have to be $100,000. It could be anything below that. But I love this. This is a great planning aspect, a great estate planning aspect. And if your intent is charitable, it's a no-brainer. So I hope they put that back into the law. But as of right now, it has not been extended.
So to close this piece out. So having people do it right now, directly to the charity, could complicate their tax planning if it's not extended for at least another year.
Absolutely, I would. Okay. Like I said, if you're doing it from a tax perspective, you need to sit down with your advisor, tax advisor or, you know, financial advisor to plan for this. This is really a tremendous planning opportunity for 2014 that, you know, in that month of December, talking to a lot of our clients and with a lot of the investment advisors, these were great plans. So, you know, when you're looking at kind of proactivity and planning, this is where the value of a good financial advisor and a good tax advisor comes into play. So,
All right. Well, I know a couple of those.
I do too.
Segueing into, again, preserving social capital here, you and I have chatted with people. Tax planning is done throughout the year. It's not when you do your returns now for 2014. Not a lot of planning can be done in 2015 for 2014. But we've talked about, so we're making IRA distributions directly to charities. Hopefully that will continue. What about private foundations? How can that help the types of folks that we've been meeting with and have the good fortune to consult to, Chris?
Yeah, these are actually pretty interesting. And again, you know, essentially a private family foundation, they're considered a charitable organization for tax purposes. So any of the earnings that these foundation assets are in, they're all tax exempt and can be distributed to charities that you choose. So what happens is that you get a family or somebody who has significant money or any type of money, and they create a family foundation, and what you'd like to do is to kind of put highly appreciated assets inside of it. What happens is you get an immediate tax deduction for the money
Let me jump in here. What dollar amounts? Because when people hear private foundations, they're thinking hundreds of millions of dollars. What can a family around here in the Farmington Valley? What would you say you would need to have to get
I would say that, I mean, anything that you, I mean, it's got to make sense, because again, there's a lot of tax benefits to it. But I mean, I would probably say maybe more than $250,000 is probably something that I would say. Probably $250,000 up. You know, because you know what happens here is that you get an immediate tax deduction. Now, when you contribute highly appreciated assets, you're pulling these assets out of your estate. So there's an estate planning tactic to it also, and essentially you would get a tax deduction on your tax return. For the deduction would be up to about 30% of your adjusted gross income, or 20% for appreciated property, and you could take that deduction on your tax return and carry it forward for a couple of years, which is nice. So there's an estate planning side to it, but then there's also, like I said, so what happens is you put these assets in there. There's a requirement that you got to distribute at least 5% of the assets each year to public charities. And the other interesting thing is you can employ your family, and you could pay them as directors. And
It also is a multi-generational planning technique to get the next generation involved in good works and shepherding the family assets and in being involved in investing, if you will. So again, you can put children and grandchildren on this in these foundations, and then they can get some sort of exposure to all the family stuff, and there are tax benefits to that also?
Well, absolutely. I mean, because again, what happens is that you can pay these family members, a salary or a director fee. And like I said, it's going to be taxable income to them, but, it gives them an opportunity to get into the mix, to be a part of it, because the problem that we see a lot, and I was just having this conversation with a client the other day, is what our family doesn't know about, us as far as our affairs and our arrangements and how things are going. So there seems to be a pretty decent disconnect, Dan, between this stuff. So this really, I think, is a great family aspect. Not only does it help pull some assets out of your estate that are highly appreciated and getting a tax benefit, but also kind of, allowing these children and family members to be accountable and to provide them with knowledge of family affairs, what's going on, and it really works. It's really interesting. I've seen a lot of clients do it, and there are specific people that help assist in setting that stuff up. I do not do that, but it's really interesting if read up on it and take advantage of it, because I think somebody with some sizable income can accomplish a lot of good estate planning benefits and also immediate tax benefits that you can get from the charitable donation. So,
all right. Excellent. Melody here. There's the I've got the 2-minute warning sign. So any last second calls, you got 2 minutes. And we're at 929-477-1568. Chris, there's many other questions that I had here, so we're going to have to perhaps circle back with you. I know you're busy taking care of everyone's taxes. A lot of the folks that we're working with, Chris is, as a matter of fact, I got a tax return from the firm to review for clients this morning. So we'll let you get back to what you're doing. Sum up things, a lot of different issues, a lot of changes. It's harnessing the power of true success, people. Great lifestyle plus money multiplied by the time to enjoy it. That's what we're here for. So until next time, we say farewell. Chris, again, thank you. Chris Elliott,
thank you guys. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
CPA, good man, all around good guy. And Melody, thank you for making sure that this went off seamlessly. And we will talk to everyone soon. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.